Keep the Aspidistra Flying by George Orwell. Chapter 1. The clock struck 2:30. In the little office at the back of Mr. McKechnie's bookshop, Gordon Comstock, last member of the Comstock family, aged 29 and rather moth-eaten already, lounged across the table, pushing a fourpenny packet of player's weights open and shut with his thumb. The ding-dong of another remoter clock, from the Prince of Wales, the other side of the street, rippled the stagnant air. Gordon made an effort, sat upright, and stowed his packet of cigarettes away in his inside pocket. He was perishing for a smoke. However, there were only 4 cigarettes left. Today was Wednesday, and he had no money coming to him till Friday. It would be too bloody to be without tobacco tonight, as well as all tomorrow. Bored in advance by tomorrow's tobacco-less hours, he got up and moved towards the door. A small, frail figure, with delicate bones and fretful movements. His coat was out at elbow in the right sleeve, and its middle button was missing. His ready-made flannel trousers were stained and shapeless. Even from above, you could see that his shoes needed resoling. The money clinked in his trouser pocket as he got up. He knew the precise sum that was there. 5 pence halfpenny. 2 pence halfpenny and a joey. He paused, took out the miserable little threepenny bit and looked at it. Beastly, useless thing. And bloody fool to have taken it. It had happened yesterday when he was buying cigarettes. Don't mind a threepenny bit, do you, sir? The little bitch of a shop girl had chirped. And, of course, he had let her give it him. Oh, no, not at all, he had said. Fool. Bloody fool. His heart sickened to think that he had only 5 pence halfpenny in the world, threepence of which couldn't even be spent. Because how can you buy anything with a threepenny bit? It isn't a coin. It's the answer to a riddle. You look such a fool when you take it out of your pocket. Unless it's in among a whole handful of other coins. How much, you say? Threepence, shop girl says. And then you feel all round your pocket and fish out that absurd little thing all by itself, sticking on the end of your finger like a tiddlywink. The shop girl sniffs. She spots immediately that it's your last threepence in the world. You see her glance quickly at it. She's wondering whether there's a piece of Christmas pudding still sticking to it. And you stalk out with your nose in the air and can't ever go to that shop again. No. We won't spend our joey. 2 pence halfpenny left. 2 pence halfpenny to last till Friday. This was the lonely after-dinner hour when few or no customers were to be expected. He was alone with 7,000 books. The small dark room, smelling of dust and decayed paper that gave on the office, was filled to the brim with books, mostly aged and unsaleable. On the top shelves near the ceiling, the quarto volumes of extinct encyclopedias slumbered on their sides in piles, like the tiered coffins in common graves. Gordon pushed aside the blue, dust-sodden curtains that served as a doorway to the next room. This, better lighted than the other, contained the lending library. It was one of those Tuppenny-no-deposit libraries beloved of book-pinchers. No books in it except novels, of course. And what novels? But that too was a matter of course. 800 strong, the novels lined the room on 3 sides, ceiling high, row upon row of gaudy oblong backs as though the walls had been built of many coloured bricks laid upright. They were arranged alphabetically. Arlen, Burroughs, Deeping, Dell, Frankau, Galsworthy, Gibbs, Priestley, Sapper, Walpole. Gordon eyed them with inert hatred. At this moment he hated all books, and novels most of all. Horrible to think of all that soggy, half-baked trash massed together in one place. Pudding. Suet pudding. 800 slabs of pudding, walling him in, a vault of pudding stone. The thought was oppressive. He moved on through the open doorway into the front part of the shop. In doing so, he smoothed his hair. It was an habitual movement. After all, there might be girls outside the glass door. Gordon was not impressive to look at. He was just 5 feet 7 inches high, and because his hair was usually too long, he gave the impression that his head was a little too big for his body. He was never quite unconscious of his small stature. When he knew that anyone was looking at him, he carried himself very upright, throwing a chest with a you-be-damned air which occasionally deceived simple people. However, there was nobody outside. The front room, unlike the rest of the shop, was smart and expensive-looking, and it contained about 2,000 books, exclusive of those in the window. On the right there was a glass showcase in which children's books were kept. Gordon averted his eyes from a beastly Rackamesque dust jacket, elvish children tripping wendily through a bluebell glade. He gazed out through the glass door. A foul day, and the wind rising. The sky was leaden. The cobbles of the street were slimy. It was St. Andrew's Day, the 30th of November. McKechnie's stood on a corner, on a sort of shapeless square where 4 streets converged. To the left, just within sight from the door, stood a great elm tree, leafless now, its multitudinous twigs making sepia-coloured lace against the sky. Opposite, next to the Prince of Wales, were tall hoardings, covered with ads for patent foods and patent medicines, exhorting you to rot your guts with this or that synthetic garbage. A gallery of monstrous doll faces, pink, vacuous faces full of goofy optimism. QT sauce. True wheat breakfast crisps. Kiddies clamour for their breakfast crisps. Kangaroo burgundy. Vitamalt chocolate. Bovex. Of them all, the Bovex one oppressed Gordon the most. A spectacled, rat-faced clerk with patent leather hair, sitting at a cafe table grinning over a white mug of Bovex. Roland Butter enjoys his meal with Bovex, the legend ran. Gordon shortened the focus of his eyes. From the dust-dulled pane, the reflection of his own face looked back at him. Not a good face. Not 30 yet, but moth-eaten already. Very pale, with bitter, ineradicable lines. What people called a good forehead, high, that is, but a small, pointed chin, so that the face as a whole was pear-shaped rather than oval. Hair, mouse-coloured and unkempt. Mouth, unamiable. Eyes, hazel, inclining to green. He lengthened the focus of his eyes again. He hated mirrors nowadays. Outside all was bleak and wintry. A tram, like a raucous swan of steel, glided groaning over the cobbles, and in its wake the wind swept a debris of trampled leaves. The twigs of the elm tree were swirling, straining eastward. The poster that advertised QT sauce was torn at the edge. A ribbon of paper fluttered fitfully like a tiny pennant. In the side street, too, to the right, the naked poplars that lined the pavement bowed sharply as the wind caught them, a nasty, raw wind. There was a threatening note in it as it swept over, the first growl of winter's anger. 2 lines of a poem struggled for birth in Gordon's mind. Sharply the something wind, for instance, threatening wind? No, better, menacing wind. The menacing wind blows over... No, sweeps over, say, the something poplars. Yielding poplars? No, better, bending poplars. Assonance between bending and menacing? No matter. The bending poplars newly bare. Good. Sharply the menacing wind sweeps over the bending poplars newly bare. Good. Bare is a sod to rhyme. However, there's always air, which every poet since Chaucer has been struggling to find rhymes for. But the impulse died away in Gordon's mind. He turned the money over in his pocket. 2d halfpenny and a joey. 2d halfpenny. His mind was sticky with boredom. He couldn't cope with rhymes and adjectives. You can't with only tuppence halfpenny in your pocket. His eyes refocused themselves upon the posters opposite. Foul, bloody things. He had his private reasons for hating them. Mechanically, he reread their slogans. Kangaroo Burgundy, the wine for Britons. QT sauce keeps hubby smiling. Hike all day on a slab of Vitamalt. Are you a highbrow? Dandruff is the reason. Kiddies clamour for their breakfast crisps. Pyorrhea? Not me. Roland Butter enjoys his meal with Bovex. Ah, a customer. Potential at any rate. Gordon stiffened himself. Standing by the door, you could get an oblique view out of the front window without being seen yourself. He looked the potential customer over. A decentish middle-aged man, black suit, bowler hat, umbrella and dispatch case. Provincial solicitor or town clerk, keeking at the window with large, pale-coloured eyes. He wore a guilty look. Gordon followed the direction of his eyes. Ah, so that was it. He had nosed out those D.H. Lawrence first editions in the far corner. Pining for a bit of smut, of course. He had heard of Lady Chatterley afar off. A bad face he had, Gordon thought. Pale, heavy, downy, with bad contours. Welsh, by the look of him. Nonconformist, anyway. He had the regular dissenting pouches round the corners of his mouth. At home, president of the local Purity League or Seaside Vigilance Committee, rubber-soled slippers and electric torch spotting kissing couples along the beach parade, and now, up in town, on the razzle. Gordon wished he would come in. Sell him a copy of Women in Love. How it would disappoint him. But no, the Welsh solicitor had funked it. He tucked his umbrella under his arm and moved off with righteously turned backside. But doubtless tonight, when darkness hid his blushes, he'd slink into one of the rubber shops and buy hijinks in a Parisian convent by Sadie Black Eyes. Gordon turned away from the door and back to the bookshelves. In the shelves to your left as you came out of the library, the new and nearly new books were kept. A patch of bright colour that was meant to catch the eye of anyone glancing through the glass door. Their sleek, unspotted backs seemed to yearn at you from the shelves. Buy me, they seemed to be saying. Novels fresh from the press, still unravished brides pining for the paper knife to deflower them, and review copies like youthful widows blooming still, though virgin no longer, and here and there, in sets of half a dozen, those pathetic spinster things, remainders, still guarding hopefully their long-preserved virginity. Gordon turned his eyes away from the remainders. They called up evil memories. The single wretched little book that he himself had published 2 years ago had sold exactly 153 copies and then been remaindered. And even as a remainder, it hadn't sold. He passed the new books by and paused in front of the shelves which ran at right angles to them and which contained more second-hand books. Over to the right were shelves of poetry. Those in front of him were prose, a miscellaneous lot. Upwards and downwards they were graded, from clean and expensive at eye level to cheap and dingy at top and bottom. In all bookshops there goes on a savage Darwinian struggle in which the works of living men gravitate to eye level and the works of dead men go up or down, down to Gehenna or up to the throne, but always away from any position where they will be noticed. Down in the bottom shelves, the classics, the extinct monsters of the Victorian age, were quietly rotting. Scott, Carlyle, Meredith, Ruskin, Pater, Stevenson, you could hardly read the names upon their broad, dowdy backs. In the top shelves, almost out of sight, slept the pudgy biographies of dukes. Below those, saleable still and therefore placed within reach, was religious literature. All sects and all creeds lumped indiscriminately together. The World Beyond, by the author of Spirit Hands Have Touched Me. Dean Farrar's Life of Christ. Jesus, the First Rotarian. Father Hilaire Chestnut's latest book of RC propaganda. Religion always sells, provided it is soppy enough. Below, exactly at eye level, was the contemporary stuff. Priestley's latest. Dinky little books of reprinted middles. Cheer Up Humour from Herbert and Knox and Milne. Some highbrow stuff as well, a novel or two by Hemingway and Virginia Woolf. Smart, pseudo-straighty, pre-digested biographies. Snooty, refined books on safe painters and safe poets by those moneyed young beasts who glide so gracefully from Eton to Cambridge and from Cambridge to the literary reviews. Dull-eyed, he gazed at the wall of books. He hated the whole lot of them, old and new, highbrow and lowbrow, snooty and chirpy. The mere sight of them brought home to him his own sterility. For here was he, supposedly a writer, and he couldn't even write. It wasn't merely a question of not getting published. It was that he produced nothing, or next to nothing. And all that tripe cluttering the shelves, well, at any rate, it existed. It was an achievement of sorts. Even the Dells and Deepings do at least turn out their yearly acre of print. But it was the snooty, cultured kind of books that he hated the worst. Books of criticism and belles lettres. The kind of thing that those moneyed young beasts from Cambridge write almost in their sleep, and that Gordon himself might have written if he had had a little more money. Money and culture. In a country like England, you can no more be cultured without money than you can join the cavalry club. With the same instinct that makes a child waggle a loose tooth, he took out a snooty-looking volume, Some Aspects of the Italian Baroque, opened it, read a paragraph, and shoved it back with mingled loathing and envy. That devastating omniscience, that noxious, horn-spectacled refinement, and the money that such refinement means, for after all, what is there behind it except money? Money for the right kind of education, money for influential friends, money for leisure and peace of mind, money for trips to Italy. Money writes books, money sells them. Give me not righteousness, O Lord, give me money, only money. He jingled the coins in his pocket. He was nearly 30 and had accomplished nothing, only his miserable book of poems that had fallen flatter than any pancake. And ever since, for 2 whole years, he had been struggling in the labyrinth of a dreadful book that never got any further, and which, as he knew in his moments of clarity, never would get any further. It was the lack of money, simply the lack of money, that robbed him of the power to write. He clung to that as to an article of faith. Money, money, all is money. Could you write even a penny novelette without money to put heart in you? Invention, energy, wit, style, charm, they've all got to be paid for in hard cash. Nevertheless, as he looked along the shelves, he felt himself a little comforted. So many of the books were faded and unreadable. After all, we're all in the same boat. Memento mori. For you and for me and for the snooty young men from Cambridge, the same oblivion waits. Though doubtless it'll wait rather longer for those snooty young men from Cambridge. He looked at the time-dulled classics near his feet. Dead. All dead. Carlyle and Ruskin, and Meredith and Stevenson, all are dead. God rot them. He glanced over their faded titles. Collected Letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. Ah, that's good. Collected Letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. Its top edge was black with dust. Dust thou art, to dust returnest. Gordon kicked Stevenson's buckram backside. Art there, old false penny? Your cold meat, if ever Scotchman was. Ping, the shop bell. Gordon turned round. 2 customers for the library. A dejected, round-shouldered, lower-class woman, looking like a draggled duck nosing among garbage, seeped in, fumbling with a rush basket. In her wake hopped a plump little sparrow of a woman, red-cheeked, middle-class, carrying under her arm a copy of the Forsyte Saga, title outwards so that passers-by could spot her for a highbrow. Gordon had taken off his sour expression. He greeted them with the homey, family doctor geniality reserved for library subscribers. Good afternoon, Mrs. Weaver. Good afternoon, Mrs. Penn. What terrible weather. Shocking, said Mrs. Penn. He stood aside to let them pass. Mrs. Weaver upset her rush basket and spilled onto the floor a much-thumbed copy of Ethel M. Dell's Silver Wedding. Mrs. Penn's bright bird eye lighted upon it. Behind Mrs. Weaver's back, she smiled up at Gordon archly, as highbrow to highbrow. Dell. The loners of it. The books these lower classes read. Understandingly, he smiled back. They passed into the library, highbrow to highbrow, smiling. Mrs. Penn laid the Forsyte Saga on the table and turned her sparrow bosom upon Gordon. She was always very affable to Gordon. She addressed him as Mr. Comstock, shop walker though he was, and held literary conversations with him. There was the freemasonry of highbrows between them. I hope you enjoyed the Forsyte Saga, Mrs. Penn. Oh, what a perfectly marvellous achievement that book is, Mr. Comstock. Do you know that that makes the fourth time I've read it an epic, a real epic? Mrs. Weaver nosed among the books, too dim-witted to grasp that they were in alphabetical order. I don't know what to have this week, that I don't, she mumbled through untidy lips. My daughter, she keeps on at me to ever try it Deeping. She's great on Deeping, my daughter is, but my son-in-law now, he's more for Barrows. Well, I don't know, I'm sure. A spasm passed over Mrs. Penn's face at the mention of Burroughs. She turned her back markedly on Mrs. Weaver. What I feel, Mr. Comstock, is that there's something so big about Galsworthy. He's so broad, so universal, and yet at the same time so thoroughly English in spirit, so human. His books are real human documents. And Priestley, too, said Gordon. I think Priestley's such an awfully fine writer, don't you? Oh, he is so big, so broad, so human, so essentially English. Mrs. Weaver pursed her lips. Behind them were three isolated yellow teeth. I think perhaps I can't do better than have another Dell, she said. You have got some more Dells, haven't you? I do enjoy a good read of Dell, I must say. I says to my daughter, I says, you can keep your Deepings and your Burroughses. Give me Dell, I says. Ding-dong Dell. Dukes and dog-whips. Mrs. Penn's eyes signalled highbrow irony. Gordon returned her signal. Keep in with Mrs. Penn, a good steady customer. Oh, certainly, Mrs. Weaver, we've got a whole shelf by Ethel M. Dell. Would you like The Desire of His Life? Or perhaps you've read that. Then what about The Altar of Honour. I wonder whether you have Hugh Walpole's latest book, said Mrs. Penn. I feel in the mood this week for something epic, something big. Now, Walpole, you know, I consider a really great writer. I put him second only to Galsworthy. There's something so big about him, and yet he's so human with it. And so essentially English, said Gordon. Oh, of course, so essentially English. I believe I'll just have The Way of an Eagle over again, said Mrs. Weaver finally. You don't never seem to get tired of The Way of an Eagle, do you now? It's certainly astonishingly popular, said Gordon diplomatically, his eye on Mrs. Penn. Astonishingly, echoed Mrs. Penn, ironically, her eye on Gordon. He took their tuppences and sent them happy away. Mrs. Penn with Walpole's Rogue Heres, and Mrs. Weaver with The Way of an Eagle. Soon he had wandered back to the other room and towards the shelves of poetry. A melancholy fascination those shelves had for him. His own wretched book was there, skied, of course, high up among the unsaleable. Mice by Gordon Comstock. A sneaky little foolscap octavo, price 3 and 6, but now reduced to a bob. Of the 13 BFs who had reviewed it, and the Times Lit Sup had declared that it showed exceptional promise, not one had seen the none too subtle joke of that title, and in the 2 years he had been at McKechnie's bookshop, not a single customer, not a single one, had ever taken mice out of its shelf. There were 15 or 20 shelves of poetry. Gordon regarded them sourly. Dud stuff, for the most part. A little above eye level, already on their way to heaven and oblivion, were the poets of yesteryear, the stars of his earlier youth. Yeats, Davis, Houseman, Thomas, Delamere, Hardy. Dead stars. Below them, exactly at eye level, were the squibs of the passing minute. Eliot, Pound, Auden, Campbell, Day-Lewis, Spender. Very damp squibs, that lot. Dead stars above, damp squibs below. Shall we ever again get a writer worth reading? But Lawrence was all right, and Joyce even better before he went off his coconut. And if we did get a writer worth reading, should we know him when we saw him? So choked as we are with trash. Ping. Shop bell. Gordon turned. Another customer. A youth of 20, cherry-lipped with gilded hair, tripped nancyfully in. Moneyed, obviously. He had the golden aura of money. He hadn't been in the shop before. Gordon assumed the gentlemanly, servile mien reserved for new customers. He repeated the usual formula. Good afternoon. Can I do anything for you? Are you looking for any particular book? Oh, no, not really. An aweless Nancy voice. May I just browse? I simply couldn't resist your front window. I have such a terrible weakness for bookshops, so I just floated in. Float out again, then, Nancy. Gordon smiled a cultured smile, as book lover to book lover. Oh, please do. We like people to look around. Are you interested in poetry by any chance? Oh, of course. I adore poetry. Of course, mangy little snob. There was a sub-artistic look about his clothes. Gordon slid a slim red volume from the poetry shelves. These are just out. They might interest you, perhaps. They're translations, something rather out of the common, translations from the Bulgarian. Very subtle, that. Now leave him to himself. That's the proper way with customers. Don't hustle them. Let them browse for 20 minutes or so. Then they get ashamed and buy something. Gordon moved to the door, discreetly, keeping out of Nancy's way, yet casually, one hand in his pocket, with the insouciant air proper to a gentleman. Outside, the slimy street looked grey and drear. From somewhere round the corner came the clatter of hooves, a cold, hollow sound. Caught by the wind, the dark columns of smoke from the chimneys veered over and rolled flatly down the sloping roofs. Ah! Sharply the menacing wind sweeps over the bending poplars newly bare, and the dark ribbons of the chimneys veer downward, tumpty-tumpty, something like murky air. Good. But the impulse faded. His eye fell again upon the ad posters across the street. He almost wanted to laugh at them. They were so feeble, so dead alive, so unappetizing, as though anybody could be tempted by those, like succubi with pimply backsides. But they depressed him all the same. The money stink. Everywhere the money stink. He stole a glance at the Nancy, who had drifted away from the poetry shelves and taken out a large, expensive book on the Russian ballet. He was holding it delicately between his pink, non-prehensile paws, as a squirrel holds a nut, studying the photographs. Gordon knew his type. The moneyed, artistic young man. Not an artist himself, exactly, but a hanger-on of the arts. Frequenter of studios, retailer of scandal. A nice-looking boy, though, for all his Nancy-tude. The skin at the back of his neck was as silky smooth as the inside of a shell. You can't have a skin like that under 500 a year. A sort of... Gordon thought of Ravelston, his charming, rich friend, editor of Antichrist, of whom he was extravagantly fond, and whom he did not see so often as once in a fortnight, and of Rosemary, his girl, who loved him, adored him, so she said, and who, all the same, had never slept with him. Money, once again. All his money. All human relationships must be purchased with money. If you have no money, men won't care for you. Women won't love you. Won't, that is, care for you or love you the last little bit that matters. And how right they are, after all. For moneyless, you are unlovable, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels. But then if I hadn't money, I don't speak with the tongues of men and of angels. He looked again at the ad posters. He really hated them this time. That Vitamalt one, for instance. Hike all day on a slab of Vitamalt. A youthful couple, boy and girl, in clean-minded hiking kit, their hair picturesquely tousled by the wind, climbing a stile against a Sussex landscape. That girl's face, the awful, bright, tomboy cheeriness of it. The kind of girl who goes in for plenty of clean fun. Windswept, tight khaki shorts, but that doesn't mean you can pinch her backside. And next to them, Roland Butter. Roland Butter enjoys his meal with Bovex. Gordon examined the thing with the intimacy of hatred. The idiotic grinning face like the face of a self-satisfied rat, the slick black hair, the silly spectacles. Roland Butter, heir of the ages, victor of Waterloo. Roland Butter, modern man, as his masters want him to be. A docile little porker, sitting in the money sty, drinking Bovex. Faces passed, wind yellowed. A tram boomed across the square, and the clock over the Prince of Wales struck three. A couple of old creatures, a tramp or beggar, and his wife, in long, greasy overcoats that reached almost the ground, were shuffling towards the shop. Book pinchers, by the look of them. Better keep an eye on the boxes outside. The old man halted on the curb a few yards away while his wife came to the door. She pushed it open and looked up at Gordon between grey strings of hair with a sort of hopeful malevolence. "Do you buy books?" she demanded hoarsely. "Sometimes. It depends what books they are." "I've got some lovely books there." She came in, shutting the door with a clang. The Nancy glanced over his shoulder distastefully and moved a step or two away into the corner. The old woman had produced a greasy little sack from under her overcoat. She moved confidentially nearer to Gordon. She smelt of very, very old bread crusts. "Will you have 'em?" she said, clasping the neck of the sack. "Only half a crown the lot." "What are they? Let me see them, please." "Lovely books they are," she breathed, bending over to open the sack and emitting a sudden, very powerful whiff of bread crusts. "Here," she said, and thrust an armful of filthy-looking books almost into Gordon's face. They were an 1884 edition of Charlotte M. Yonge's novels, and had the appearance of having been slept on for many years. Gordon stepped back, suddenly revolted. "We can't possibly buy those," he said shortly.
"Can't buy 'em? Why can't you buy 'em?"
"Because they're no use to us. We can't sell that kind of thing."
"What you make me take 'em out of me bag for, then?" demanded the old woman ferociously.
Gordon made a detour round her to avoid the smell, and held the door open silently. No use arguing. You had people of this type coming to the shop all day long. The old woman made off, mumbling with malevolence in the hump of her shoulders, and joined her husband. He paused on the curb to cough, so fruitily that you could hear him through the door. A clot of phlegm, like a little white tongue, came slowly out between his lips and was ejected into the gutter. Then the two old creatures shuffled away, beetle-like in the long, greasy overcoats that hid everything except their feet. Gordon watched them go. They were just by-products. The throwouts of the money god. All over London, by tens of thousands, draggled old beasts of that description, creeping like unclean beetles to the grave. He gazed out at the graceless street. At this moment it seemed to him that in a street like this, in a town like this, every life that is lived must be meaningless and intolerable. The sense of disintegration, of decay, that is endemic in our time was strong upon him. Somehow it was mixed up with the ad posters opposite. He looked now with more seeing eyes at those grinning, yard-wide faces. After all, there was more there than mere silliness, greed and vulgarity. Roland Butter grins at you, seemingly optimistic with a flash of false teeth, but what is behind the grin? Desolation. Emptiness, prophecies of doom. For can you not see, if you know how to look, that behind that slick self-satisfaction, that tittering, fat-bellied triviality, there is nothing but a frightful emptiness, a secret despair. The great death wish of the modern world. Suicide pacts. heads stuck in gas ovens in lonely maisonettes, French letters and Amen pills, and the reverberations of future wars, enemy aeroplanes flying over London, the deep threatening hum of the propellers, the shattering thunder of the bombs. It is all written in Roland Butter's face. More customers coming. Gordon stood back, gentlemanly servile. The doorbell clanged. Two upper-middle-class ladies sailed noisily in, one pink and fruity, 35-ish, with voluptuous bosom burgeoning from her coat of squirrel skin, emitting a super-feminine scent of Parma violets, the other middle-aged, tough and curried, India, presumably. Close behind them, a dark, grubby, shy young man slipped through the doorway as apologetically as a cat. He was one of the shop's best customers, a flitting, solitary creature who was almost too shy to speak, and who, by some strange manipulation, kept himself always a day away from a shave. Gordon repeated his formula. "Good afternoon. Can I do anything for you? Are you looking for any particular book?" Fruity Face overwhelmed him with a smile, but Curry Face decided to treat the question as an impertinence. Ignoring Gordon, she drew Fruity Face across to the shelves next to the new books, where the dog books and cat books were kept. The two of them immediately began taking books out of the shelves and talking loudly. Curryface had the voice of a drill sergeant. She was no doubt a colonel's wife, or widow. The Nancy, still deep in the big book on the Russian ballet, edged delicately away. His face said that he would leave the shop if his privacy were disturbed again. The shy young man had already found his way to the poetry shelves. The two ladies were fairly frequent visitors to the shop. They always wanted to see books about cats and dogs, but never actually bought anything. There were two whole shelves of dog books and cat books. Ladies' Corner, old McKechnie called it. Another customer arrived for the library. An ugly girl of 20, hatless, in a white overall, with a sallow, blithering, honest face and powerful spectacles that distorted her eyes. She was assistant at a chemist's shop. Gordon put on his homey library manner. She smiled at him, and with a gait as clumsy as a bear's, followed him into the library. "What kind of book would you like this time, Miss Weeks?" "Well," she clutched the front of her overall. Her distorted black treacle eyes beamed trustfully into his. "Well, what I'd really like is a good hot stuff love story, you know, something modern. Something modern, something by Barbara Bedworthy, for instance. Have you read Almost a Virgin?" "Oh, no, not her. She's too deep. I can't bear deep books. But I want something, well, you know, modern. Sex problems and divorce and all that, you know." "Modern but not deep," said Gordon as lowbrow to lowbrow. He ranged among the hot stuff modern love stories. There were not less than 300 of them in the library. From the front room came the voices of the two upper-middle-class ladies, the one fruity, the other curried, disputing about dogs. They had taken out one of the dog books and were examining the photographs. Fruity voice enthused over the photograph of a peak, the ickle angel pet with his great big soulful eyes and his ickle black nose, oh so ducky duck. But curry voice, yes, undoubtedly a colonel's widow, said peaks were soppy. "Give her dogs with guts, dogs that would fight," she said. "She hated these soppy lap dogs," she said.
"You have no soul, Bedelia, no soul," said Fruity Voice plaintively.
The doorbell pinged again. Gordon handed the chemist's girl 7 Scarlet Knights and booked it on her ticket. She took a shabby leather purse out of her overall pocket and paid him tuppence. He went back to the front room. The Nancy had put his book back in the wrong shelf and vanished. A lean, straight-nosed, brisk woman with sensible clothes and gold-rimmed pince-nez, schoolmarm possibly, feminist certainly, came in and demanded Mrs. Walton Beverley's history of the suffrage movement. With secret joy, Gordon told her that they hadn't got it. She stabbed his male incompetence with gimlet eyes and went out again. The thin young man stood apologetically in the corner, his face buried in D.H. Lawrence's collected poems, like some long-legged bird with its head buried under its wing. Gordon waited by the door. Outside, a shabby, genteel old man with a strawberry nose and a khaki muffler round his throat was picking over the books in the sixpenny box. The two upper-middle-class ladies suddenly departed, leaving a litter of open books on the table. Fruity Face cast reluctant backward glances at the dog books, but Curry Face drew her away, resolute not to buy anything. Gordon held the door open. The two ladies sailed noisily out, ignoring him. He watched their fur-coated upper-middle-class backs go down the street. The old strawberry-nosed man was talking to himself as he pored over the books. A bit wrong in the head, presumably. He would pinch something if he wasn't watched. The wind blew colder, drying the slime of the street. Time to light up, presently. Caught by a swirl of air, the torn strip of paper on the QT source advertisement fluttered sharply, like a piece of washing on the line. Ah, sharply the menacing wind sweeps over the bending poplars, newly bare, and the dark ribbons of the chimneys veer downward, flicked by whips of air, torn posters flutter. Not bad, not bad at all. But he had no wish to go on. Could not go on, indeed. He fingered the money in his pocket, not chinking it, lest the shy young man should hear. Tuppence halfpenny. No tobacco all tomorrow. His bones ached. A light sprang up in the Prince of Wales. They would be swabbing out the bar. The old strawberry-nosed man was reading an Edgar Wallace out of the tuppenny box. A tram boomed in the distance. In the room upstairs, Mr. McKechnie, who seldom came down to the shop, drowsed by the gas fire, white-haired and white-bearded, with snuff-box handy, over his calf-bound folio of Middleton's Travels in the Levant. The thin young man suddenly realised that he was alone, and looked up guiltily. He was an habitué of bookshops, yet never stayed longer than 10 minutes in any one shop. A passionate hunger for books, and the fear of being a nuisance, were constantly at war in him. After 10 minutes in any shop, he would grow uneasy, feel himself de trop, and take to flight, having bought something out of sheer nervousness. Without speaking, he held up the copy of Lawrence's poems and awkwardly extracted 3 florins from his pocket. In handing them to Gordon, he dropped one. Both dived for it simultaneously. Their heads bumped against one another. The young man stood back, blushing sallowly. "I'll wrap it up for you," said Gordon. But the shy young man shook his head. He stammered so badly that he never spoke when it was avoidable. He clutched his book to him and slipped out with the air of having committed some disgraceful action. Gordon was alone. He wandered back to the door. The strawberry-nosed man glanced over his shoulder, caught Gordon's eye, and moved off, foiled. He had been on the point of slipping Edgar Wallace into his pocket. The clock over the Prince of Wales struck 3:15. Ding, dong, 3:15. Light up at 3:30. 4¾ hours till closing time. 5¼ hours till supper. Tuppence halfpenny in pocket. No tobacco tomorrow. Suddenly a ravishing, irresistible desire to smoke came over Gordon. He had made up his mind not to smoke this afternoon. He had only 4 cigarettes left. They must be saved for tonight, when he intended to write, for he could no more write without tobacco than without air. Nevertheless, he had got to have a smoke. He took out his packet of player's weights and extracted one of the dwarfish cigarettes. It was sheer, stupid indulgence. It meant 30 minutes off tonight's writing time, but there was no resisting it. With a sort of shameful joy, he sucked the papery smoke into his lungs. The reflection of his own face looked back at him from the greyish pane. Gordon Comstock, author of Mice, En Longue Trentième de Son Âge, and Moth-Eaten Already. Only 26 teeth left. However, Villon, at the same age, was poxed on his own showing. Let's be thankful for small mercies. He watched the ribbon of torn paper whirling, fluttering on the QT source advertisement. Our civilization is dying. It must be dying. But it isn't going to die in its bed. Presently the aeroplanes are coming. Zoom, whiz, crash, the whole Western world going up in a roar of high explosives. He looked at the darkening street, at the greyish reflection of his face in the pane, at the shabby figures shuffling past. Almost involuntarily he repeated,
C'est la nuit. L'œil chargé d'un pleur involontaire, il rêve d'échafauds en fumant son hookah.
Money, money, roll and butter, the humming of the aeroplanes and the crash of the bombs. Gordon squinted up at the leaden sky. Those aeroplanes are coming. In imagination, he saw them coming now, squadron after squadron, innumerable, darkening the sky like clouds of gnats. With his tongue not quite against his teeth, he made a buzzing bluebottle on the window pane sound to represent the humming of the aeroplanes. It was a sound which, at that moment, he ardently desired to hear.